I was researching. It just seemed like it kept on going and going. And yeah, I'm glad it's here. I do have a handout that I'm asking ushers to pass out at this year time. There should be enough for each one. If there's not, let's get more copies made for that. I want to explain that just a wee little bit. Once you get the handout, you'll notice it's kind of divided into two columns. On the left-hand side, you have, it's a bit of a rough outline. Helps you track where I'm at. Might keep me a little bit honest, but I don't necessarily feel beholden to that. And then on the right-hand side, there's just a number of spaces there in case you're inspired to take notes, in case there's questions that come up or something is said that you're like, I want to write that down. It's here for you. And no, this is not any kind of intentional pushback against using PowerPoint. It's just the way I wanted to do it, and that's what we're doing here tonight. So I do want to clarify, this is not necessarily an anti-technology talk. So we'll get into that in a moment. When I was asked to do this talk, my thoughts first went to social media, the dangers of social media, and I'm not sure I need to do much elaboration on that, and how social media can be addicting. But I felt a discussion along those lines would have been a discussion on things that are current and not necessarily helpful in us determining what are good habits, what are good guidelines to go by when we're trying to evaluate technology and its role in our lives. So as I was pondering this more, I thought, well, how about talking about how the world gives us its values or is passing its values to us through the technology we're using, especially I'm thinking along habits of consumption and things of that nature. And I think that would have been a worthy endeavor. Well, then I actually got around to watching the message I was supposed to review, and my thoughts shifted once again. So the message I was asked to review was by a man called Brad Huddleston, and he studies neuroscience, and it was a message he gave to a church in the Philippines. It was in English, and it was very understandable, but it focused more on addiction. How does addiction work? How does technology, what's the mechanisms by which technology can actually be addicting? How we can be addicted to technology. So that's kind of where my mind went to. But I wanted to also go a little deeper. And the title of the talk tonight really kind of gets towards the heart of what I want to get to. Formation of the soul. What do our habits say about us, and how do they form who we are in the core of ourselves? But I will warn you, there's some significant backstory we need to do before we can kind of start talking about that. So I hope you can bear with me here. So last summer, I happened to stumble upon my digital well-being section on my phone, and the number was 428. And I just thought to myself, how in the world have I just wasted, not wasted, how in the world did I spend 4.5 hours on my phone today? And it really got my attention, to the point where I started thinking about that. And I was working at home, I would argue doing some of that time was spent researching on how to remodel a house on the fly. And some mild justification there. But I knew what my issue was. And that was, in particular, I was spending too much time on YouTube. And that's those thoughts that started from seeing 428 on the screen led me to consider doing a tech fast, in particular a fast from YouTube, because I want to be intentional with how I spend my time, and 4.5 hours on a phone is not intentional, even though it's fun. It's not the way I want to live my life. So I mentioned this one Sunday to Sterling Miller, and a few weeks later, I mentioned the idea of doing a fast to him, but I was like, it almost seems like it'd be better to do that with someone. Not necessarily to do it on my own. And eventually he decided to join me. His was more cutting back on just some of the mindless scrolling that can happen when you go down the rabbit hole of headline news and whatnot. We decided it was going to be for 6 months. And that seemed like a long enough stretch that it was going to take intentionality to actually get to the end of it. But in addition to that, I decided also to do a caffeine fast, primarily because I knew the research was suggesting that time on a screen, social media, and all of that is mentally stimulating. And I also knew caffeine was as well. So I combined the two and did both of those fasts simultaneously. I was curious to see if I was addicted to caffeine. That was kind of one reason for doing it. And for those of you who are dead set on having your morning coffee, no, I did not lose my joy in life. I think I was still the same person I was, even with coffee. So as we think about digital addiction, the question came up to me, and this also came from a conversation I had with my little neighbor boy, but what in my life do I consider normal that is actually harmful? I think it's a good question to ponder. This could range anything from physical influences to maybe something along like emotional or spiritual as well. And I think when it comes to technology, it's a bit insidious in the sense that it's not just a physical, it doesn't affect us just physically, it also affects us in non-physical ways as well. And so it's kind of a bit of a dual hit there, if you will. Now, as we get into it, I want to make a disclaimer quickly to three different disclaimers. One, as we're talking about technology, I find it difficult to separate between what it is physically and what social media is, okay? I'll try to be clear when we're referring to which one, but those lines get muddy. And also, what is normal use and what is addiction? What is compulsive? Second disclaimer is, I think in this group, there are a number of different categories of people, and I just want to address that up front. One group might be those who you don't use technology, you don't use it a lot, or you're not even on social media. That's fine. Some of the stuff we talk about tonight, you may not have any experience with, but hopefully it's a way of enlightening you as to what are the potential pitfalls and dangers with technology. Secondly, there's those of us, I say those of us, there may be some of us here who use it and we're not addicted, right? That's fine. It's not meant to be a shame talk or to try to get you to really do something differently or whatever. And then the last group of people are those of us who we use digital technology on a daily basis, whether it's for job, we're on social media, whatever. That's fine. Again, this is not meant to be a shame. And also the third disclaimer is, if you've come here tonight expecting me to talk about this or that application of technology is wrong, I'm not sure you'll find it. This is more meant to be developing habits and, if you will, opening the door to the tool shed so that we know what tools we have available to help us think about technology. All right, so what is technology? I'll let you think about that for a little bit. But as we talk about media ecology, which is the study of media and communications and things of that nature, there are two men who really do sort of stand out. The first one is Marshall McLuhan. He was a Canadian philosopher who talked a lot about how media affects us in ways we don't understand. In many ways, he predicted the internet long before its time. The second one was a student of his by the name of Neil Postman. And he was also a media theorist, wrote two books. One was Amusing Ourselves to Death, highly recommend that book, as well as Technopoly, The Surrender of Culture to Technology. So I'm just putting those two names out there in case you're interested in studying more about this, or if I mention names, it'll likely be these, and that's why they show up. So what is technology? And again, I'm not sure what answer you would give. Technology is also, as we talk about technology, two words, media and medium, also come up as well. If you look at the top of the handout I gave you, you see the medium is the message. We'll get to that in a minute. But in that sense, McLuhan is also talking about technology. But he's not talking about technology as we think about it. So the answer we'll use for technology is any device that extends or amplifies a part of us. All right, so it's something that extends a capability we as humans have. And taken to the extreme, for someone like McLuhan, who is a professor and really studied this, that ranges from cars to clothes to even credit cards. Again, it's a bit of a mild extreme. How does all that amplify a capacity of the human body? I'm sure he could tell you. We won't dive that deep into us. So I've got some object lessons here. As we think about technology and it extending human capacity, I'm sure if I had asked you or taken answers as to what technology is, you probably would not have said a hammer or binoculars, maybe a clock. And let me back up a little bit. Also in your handout, there I have a quote in there by Nicholas Carr, who wrote the book The Shallows. He wrote, "Our tools end up numbing whatever part of the body they amplify. Whenever we extend some part of ourselves, we also distance ourselves from the amplified part and its natural functions." So as we think about something like the hammer, right? So this amplifies what I can do with my hand. But what it numbs is dexterity. It's really difficult, if I'm holding this, to pick up a screw, pick up a nail. Something like that, right? It's and of course, if you have a hammer, all problems look like nails. Either beat it up or rip it out, right? The same holds true for a pair of binoculars. It allows you to see further, but when these are at your face, you don't have peripheral vision. You can't see the stuff just to the side of it. Similarly, a clock might be a bit more subtle, but it allows us to accurately mark the passage of time. That's fine. What it distances ourselves, or what it numbs for a lot of us, is the natural rhythm of life. Because everything is now measurable from a time perspective. And I think that has merit for us to think about the tools we use, about the technology we use. What is it amplifying? What's it making, in a sense, better for us? But concurrently, there's also a loss there that I think we need to think critically about as well. And so understanding media as an extension of ourselves is key to understanding media. And again, bear in mind that for McLuhan, media and technology are somewhat synonymous. So if we're using these terms sort of interchangeably, it's okay. They kind of mean the same. When we fail to see media this way, we become overly enamored with them, which gives them the power to make us slaves to our own creations. So when we don't understand what the devices are in a correct sense, we become so enamored with it, right? That in that sense, we become a slave to that technology. We become so concerned about keeping track of time that we might value time at the sense of a conversation with a friend that's going really well. But because we're a master, we're addicted to, you know, keeping time, we lose that relational sense. That would be one way of explaining it. Moving on, I want to look at three different types of communication technology: ideographic writing, phonetic writing, and electronic medium. But I want to talk a little bit about the quote at the top of your page. The medium is the message. What I want to look at in this next section is the way that we think based on language, based on writing in some ways. And for this next section, I am indebted to Shane Hipps and his book for these insights. So ideographic writing, it sounds like something obscure, but if I say it like a Chinese alphabet or the Eastern languages that are more pictorial, I think you'll understand what we're talking about. The Chinese had the printing press hundreds of years before Gutenberg invented his. But there's a simple reason why it didn't take off as quickly or as widespread as Gutenberg's did, and it's simply due to the sheer complexity of the Chinese language. There's, do I have it right, Frida? Over 80,000 characters in the alphabet. That's what Shane was saying in the book. Now, one advantage maybe to the Chinese language is that one character can represent just an entire thought, right? And when you compare that to phonetic writing, one character means nothing. We could draw a T. What does a T mean? It means nothing until it's put in sequence with other characters as well. So as we think about ideographic writing, and we think about the philosophy that springs from that, it is not linear in its approach. It's more holistic, intuitive. And when you think about some of Asian philosophy, you can kind of see where that influence comes from. Now, phonetic writing, on the other hand, especially with English, we only have 26 characters. It's much more brief. It's an abstract way of writing. Again, unless we're putting letters together. And that arranging, the arranging letters means that the language itself needs to be specific. And it's no surprise then that the philosophy that comes out of that type of language tends to be, that type of alphabet tends to be linear and sequential in thought. And as Westerners, we are deeply impacted by the medium of print. And to just list a couple, it made us more individualistic. We were no longer reliant on oral, the tribal memory that comes from an oral culture. It introduced objectivity. I can put my thoughts on a page, and I can stand back from them, and I can observe them. So it creates distance in that sense between the thinker and their ideas. And that's different than an oral culture. And as we talked about, it intensifies linear irrational thinking. And this is a blessing because it allows us to access, for example, Paul's writings in ways that are different from the Gospels, which can be depicted with pictures or stained glass, like we see happening with the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages. And it, for the church, it emphasized objectivity, a meta-narrative, and linear knowledge that is based on some truth, Scripture and God as the author of truth. Moving on to electronic media. So the telegraph ushered in the age of electronic media in many ways. And the unique thing that the telegraph did for human communication is it cuts the relationship between communication and transportation. You could send out a message instantly. And because information was available that quickly, information became a commodity, right? The newspaper that had the latest scoop had the newspaper sales because they had the latest information. So prior to the telegraph, the information we had was local. It was rooted in culture and a place. Telegraph takes it from that its local setting, sends it out, it's no longer connected to people, and it becomes a fabric, a mosaic of somewhat unconnected data points. So think when you look at a newspaper, if you do so these days, or even just your Google feed, you see headlines that are not related to each other, right? See worries about inflation, then right below that you might see an earthquake in some part of the world, and right below that you might see something else. They're not connected, right? Also before the telegraph, information was gathered for the purpose of deepening our understanding and wisdom, but after the telegraph, its only value becomes how fresh it is, how current it is. We see similarities in our current media scene as well. And one key thing, the telegraph only moved information. It did not interpret or analyze it. In contrast, information that's rooted locally, it means something to us, therefore we're going to try to understand and deepen our own understanding and wisdom. So some of the effects of this telegraph or that of instant information is we see the slow death of the meta-narrative. Truth starts becoming local, starts becoming more personal, starts becoming more, in a way, abstract. There is no supremacy of truth. It's all interconnected. In a sense, it's also mirroring the interconnectivity of telegraph and our electronic devices today. Another aspect of electronic media I want to quick touch on is that of photography. In a way, this is a return back to the Middle Ages and iconography, of explaining a story with a picture, except with the invention of the telegraph or other devices. This is now available at basically light speed as well. And also, by invoking intuition and emotion, it further weakens our preference for logic and linear thinking. And in some ways, it furthers a subjective experience over truth and reality, what I feel about what I see type of approach. So if I can just quick recap, phonetic writing trends toward a left brain versus more of a right brain approach of electronic media, telegraph and photograph, as we're talking about it for right now. Phonetic writing trends towards rationality and a linear thought process and logic. Electronic media tends more to be more towards intuition, non-linear thinking, and emotion-based. Phonetic writing allows for truth and objectivity, as well as private introspection. Electronic media is more of a subjective experience, as well as a sharing of information and experience as well. So there's key differences here. Now, as we think about the immediacy of the telegraph and the emotional pull of what photography brings, and we put that into the palm of our hand, is there any wonder why it feels like we're swimming in this sea of disconnected information? It's kind of because we are. We have information flowing around us at all times. Why is it so hard to find moments for self-reflection and deep thought when we have these guys available at hand's reach? Partly because it's intentional. Shane Hipps, in his book, would also argue that the electronic culture, or the electronic medium, has shaped how Christians think and act towards church and church worship. In some ways, it has led to more of intentional community, of small groups, a structure less of a guide or a shepherd leading a group, and more towards just, we're all in this together. Let me hear your experience. I'll share mine. And we kind of figure this out. Of validating experience as part of worship and teaching, and in some circles, they're incorporating more of the sacramental practices from Catholic and Orthodox tradition. Trying to see if I have enough time to stick in another piece of information. I think I do, because I think there's some things here for us to consider. So when we think about a print, how the medium of printing has has affected us, as Christians, we serve a God whose Son is self-identified as the Word. And I think that brings about objectivity, it brings about truth. And yet, on the other hand, we have the four Gospels, which are four different perspectives on how this person who embodies truth lived, right? So we have the objective and we have the subjective. Now, one danger with the emphasis of print and linear thinking is that we focus specifically on getting theology right. Let's just get it nailed down. And one danger that approach has then towards maybe some emerging church tendencies is the danger of discarding other people's experience. We don't validate what other people experienced as well. And I think for the church, as we consider Jesus as the Word, the Gospels bring in different perspectives, there's a call to balance truth with the intuition and the emotion that we find in the Psalms. And I think the last year, with the worship that we've experienced here, we've looked at how the Psalms bring about different emotions, different human experiences. One good thing that print culture does for us is it has amplified the idea of a personal relationship with God. And yet, that emphasis can also de-emphasize the, like, the communal experience we have as a church, as a body, in our inner spiritual walk, our spiritual relationship. And also, print is a great way for communicating doctrine because of how it's structured, because of how it leads to logic that's built upon the preceding truth. It does lead well to to communicating doctrine. And with the electronic media, doctrine does not play good. Let me rephrase that. Doctrine does not play well. How do you put doctrine up on a screen? How do you present, and if we think about megachurch environments, how do you portray Jesus or God as just, or how do you even portray God in an environment where there's cameras, where there's screens, where there's, I think you get where I'm going at. The shift then is towards televisual. How good does a how good does a preacher look? How well does he communicate? How does he sound? And it's focused on the person rather than on the creator. Now, I'd like to return our focus back to the handout there and look at dopamine and try to explain with my non-medical background how addiction works. And in this point, when we start talking about digital technology, I'm specifically now focusing in on hardware or the software and the particular apps that we use. So now I think we're zooming in onto what it is that that a lot of us have questions about. I wasn't sure how my time was going to go, so I didn't take group answers to what is technology previously, but I think we're a little bit ahead of time here. As you think about addiction, as you think about maybe what it is to be addicted, what answer would you give to that question? That kind of sums it up a bit in a nutshell. For tonight, and I'm only giving my answer because I had it written out, but addiction, let me back up. Dopamine comes about when we experience pleasure. And the definition I would like to use for tonight, when we think about addiction, is simply enjoying pleasurable things too much. And there's actually a part of your brain, you can actually physically find it inside of you, that's called the pleasure center. The technical term is the nucleus accumbens. And let's think a little bit about, we'll get into the little bit of the mechanism of it, the biochemistry of it. Let's think about some things that we might be addicted to and maybe how that pleasure comes about. So for example, we can enjoy eating food. I'm sure we all do, and you all have, because you're here tonight. We derive pleasure from the senses, but we also derive pleasure from the natural chemicals that they contain. There's certain foods that they have been studied, and they are shown to increase dopamine. Things like coffee, chocolate, avocados, cheese, eggs, fish, fruit. Not sure about you, but I could make that a daily diet, and I would call it the happy diet, I think. But so that's one example there. Smoking. There are people who are nicotine addicted. And as we think about how that drug in particular works, it's delivered to the lungs, and the lungs metabolize it into the bloodstream, and then it goes to the brain. When this happens, dopamine is released, and its dopamine helps modulate or regulate the stress that the person is feeling, and therefore causes pleasure. And some of the signs of addiction could be coughing, gravelly voice, and with long-term users, it would be lung issues as well. Alcohol is something else that people are addicted to. And in that case, that drug is delivered orally, not to the lungs, but rather it's to the stomach and it's metabolized in the liver. Same process, it gets in the bloodstream, goes to the brain, and that's what causes the pleasurable feeling. Digital technology works differently. It doesn't go through the mouth, rather it goes through the eyes, and it goes straight back into the brain. There's no other bodily process involved to metabolize it. And it goes back to the pleasure center of the brain, stimulates it, and it's similar to anything else that we could possibly be addicted to. Some symptoms that go along with this are anger, anxiety and depression, and emotional numbness, or the medical term is called anhedonia, not being able to feel any emotion or feeling. Now, as we think about different things and how they raise dopamine, just give you two examples here. So food can raise our dopamine levels by about 50%. Video games will raise that 100%. So already you're starting to see science is qualifying just somehow imbalanced and how predisposed we are to being addicted. I'm not saying we all are, but how predisposed we are to being addicted to digital technology. And there's multiple studies out there that correlate excessive screen usage with just a whole host of clinical disorders. Now, your brain can handle a certain amount of dopamine. In fact, we need dopamine. I'm not being down on that. It's necessary for us to enjoy life. It keeps us interested in learning. You get into learning something and you find it exciting, you just want to keep getting into it. Well, that's dopamine that's kind of hooking you in and saying, hey, let's go deeper with this. We need dopamine to enjoy the relationship of other people. And so in a sense, you can say that people are addicting because when we have great interactions with them and we like them, we get a little bit of a rise in dopamine, a little bit of a buzz. As well as personal worship and feeling God's presence. But like I said, your brain can only handle a certain amount. Too much, it's almost like it has its own built-in regulator. Too much, and it tries to push it out. It says, no, we got enough. Well, you're not feeling the stimulation or the high, so you just keep pouring it on, right? If the wall is this high and normal dopamine is down here, just regular interactions with people aren't going to cut it. You need more. And so you keep pushing against this wall until you crest it, if you will, and you got dopamine flowing into your pleasure center. You feel good. And that's kind of how the addiction process works. The more that you use it, the higher that wall goes up, the more you need to get over that to feel that same high, that same feeling of pleasure. Now, the downside of having that that resistance wall being too high is that you enter into a state of anhedonia. We talked about that. And you're no longer deriving pleasures from non-digital activities. Things like we talked about, relationships with other people, enjoying a coffee with a friend, or enjoying worship together here with this body. All those activities, like I said, give us kind of the right-sized amount we need. But we can weaken that by the things we choose to be addicted to. And that dopamine wall is the explanation for why we feel like we need to check our phones in the middle of conversation with other people. It's because the other person's not stimulating enough. That's just kind of the bottom line. If you check your phone during the service, it's because I'm not stimulating enough. That's how it works. And yeah, it's a shame when people become boring to us. But this helps me understand why sometimes when I sit down to have my quiet time, I catch myself scrolling Instagram. I'm like, EJ, this is the time for spiritual growth and physical development. Like, this is not the time for this. But you know, once that my dopamine levels are up, I can put my phone away or I toss it onto the couch 6 feet over so it's not within hand's reach and I can have my devotions, right? My dopamine's where I want it to be and now I can focus. Moving on to personal habits. And by the way, if some of you more medically astute have issues with how I described dopamine and all that, feel free to add your thoughts later as well or talk to me after the service. So talking about personal habits, in 2021, there was a survey done of over 2,000 people. 46%, almost half, reportedly spent between 5 to 6 hours on their phone. By that metric, I was fine. I was underneath 5 hours. 11% spent more than 7 hours. So that's about 60% of people in this survey spent more than 5 hours on their phones a day. In a 2022 article from ConquerSeries.com reported that the average adult spends over 20 hours per week with digital media. And again, we're specifically talking about technology, apps, things of that nature. And in 2013, there's a study done by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it said that 8 to 10-year-olds spent 8 hours a day with various digital media, with teenagers spending up to 11. Now, before you get too dismayed at that, keep in mind this is likely counting in time they spent at school, so-called educational environments with devices. And alarmingly enough, digital addiction, when they do brain scans on people who are digitally addicted, those brain scans are looking very similar to those brain scans done on people who are addicted to heroin. So it's not out of line to compare digital technology to other forms of substance abuse. So why is digital technology so appealing? You may have different answers. I'll offer a few that I have here. Number one, it's personal. It caters to what I want, right? After 3 months of setting up a new account, whether it's on Apple or Google, or getting back onto YouTube after 6 months, it can start learning exactly what it is you want to watch, or what it is you want to read, or what it is you want to look at, and it will give you what you want. It's also personable. It gives the illusion of agreeableness that we sometimes don't get from people around us, right? There's a false sense of security as well. What I do or what I visit with technology and social media, no one needs to know. And this one is kind of directed to the younger ones among us. Apps that feature disappearing features, I think, are something we need to think seriously about. Again, the medium is the message, and you're influenced not necessarily by the content, but by what is carrying that content along. So just leave that out there for thought. Also, they are designed. Digital technology is designed to pull you in. The whole thing of endless scrolling, of refreshing your feed with things you want to read and see. It's designed that way. There is also the lie of multitasking. Digital media is appealing because, I can listen to your podcast while I'm, studying for a talk on technology or whatever the case might be. But when you're engaged in deep thought or work that requires thinking, the idea of multitasking is a lie. It's more like multi-switching. You're switching information back. You're switching your focus back and forth. And Clifford Nass, who is a professor at Stanford University, has done multiple studies showing this. Also showing studies that we do worse when we multitask. Multitask in air quotes. Reason for this is our brains think sequentially. We can't take in more than one stream of data at one time. And I thought about doing an experiment here, but I couldn't quite pull it together enough for us to do it. And as Michael mentioned in his introduction, it's necessary for modern life. Now, a case could be made we don't need it. A case could be made there are certain applications we don't need, but we're surrounded by technology. There's in a sense, no getting away or around it. It's here to stay. Now, another case can be made, or another point to prove that digital technology is appealing, comes, I think, from some of the leaders of tech companies themselves. There are a number of them who are deliberately low-tech in their home and in how they allow their children to interact with technology and with devices. A few of these, Microsoft founder Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, former Apple CEO, Google CEO Sundar Pichai, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, as well as Mark Cuban, all have put severe restrictions on their children when they were growing up regarding the use of technology. And I think that says something. If they're doing it, maybe it should be something we think about. Sorry, children. As well as among workers in Silicon Valley, there's a huge preference for low-tech school models like the Waldorf, schools that are modeled after the Waldorf method. And again, I would ask a question. If they're saying this, and these are people who are working with it every day, who are designing them to be addictive, that should give us something to think about as well, I think. So what do we do with this? What do we do with something so addicting, something so omnipresent, and something so appealing? I can't answer it. I can't answer it for you. I'm not here to say this app or that app is good or bad, or you should use Android instead of Apple, or vice versa. Like, that's not what we're talking about here tonight. So I'll just offer some questions, and it's not a comprehensive list, but I'm just offering some of these here questions for you maybe to test your personal habits against, for whatever it's worth. Why do I need it? Why do I need this technology or that app? When and how often should I use it? Tech Sabbaths, I think, are good things to think about. I think it's something we should consider, again, on a personal level, incorporating in our lives. How that looks for you might very well be different than what and how I practice it. Another question might be, does the good or the benefit I get in something outweigh the bad or the harm that I receive from it? If I say to myself, I got Instagram so I can keep track of my friends, but there may be something else that I want to follow, that's not good for me. Is it worth it for me to have Instagram? Also, another question I've pondered, because we still are keeping our hope alive in God regarding children, is if I would change something in my life so that I don't affect my children, should I not make that change now? I'm still wrestling with that question. Is the messaging I receive through digital technology in line with Philippians 4:8? And would I want others to follow what I do, like Philippians 4:9? Or is it more in line with what 1 John 2:16 talks about? How does tech help or hinder my relationship with Jesus? In light of the fact that everything I do is formative and it shapes my spirit, do I want to become the person I see myself becoming? Do I want to be the one who always knows the latest stats on sports teams or players? Do I want to be the one who knows, you fill in the blank. Do I want to be known as a person who doesn't have time for their friends because they need to do X, Y, and Z and it's related to technology? They're playing video games with their friends or something, another set of friends. Is that who I want to be known as? I'm struggling to find a parallel for the adults, but I'm sure it's there. Can I foresee who I might become by my use of technology, and am I okay with becoming that person? And last question I have here is, how am I prioritizing digital technology at the expense of analog activities or non-digital activities, or creating? So in other words, I'm pulling a lot of these scenarios from my own life, but if Angela wants to take a walk around the block, but I say, no, I gotta check my email. Like, I have to, right? Because inbox zero is very elusive, for those of you who know. That is me prioritizing digital technology over something very beneficial in something that's non-digital. I'm putting a relationship, I'm giving priority to technology at the expense of a relationship. Now, one pesky little truth. I wasn't quite sure where to wedge this in my talk, and I also couldn't find a secondary source to support this. So if you have it, feel free to let me know. But this comes from Brian Huddleston in his talk, Digital Cocaine. He says, your brain does not distinguish content. It is not immune to the quality of the content. It does not see educational content and say, since it's not illicit, I'm not attracted to it. Educational content is just as addictive as anything else. The brain only responds to only reacts to dopamine inputs based on stimulation. And again, I wish I could find a second source to verify that. But he's saying, regardless of what's on the screen, screens are stimulating. They increase our dopamine. And which, yes, why, you know, as we talked about, increase of dopamine increases our risk of being addicted. McLuhan has another statement. He says, we shape our tools, and afterward, our tools shape us. And we're getting into the closing section here. And so I'm offering just a few strategies for how to combat this. We can't control what a company like Facebook or Apple or TikTok, what kind of digital products they might create or what they do with their companies. But we can shape our habits of use. Question is, how will we do so? And even more fundamental, will we do so? Will we actually be disciplined to allow ourselves to be disciplined by some of these here habits or tools? So Brad Huddleston, at the end of his talk, gave 7 steps. And then we'll get to what the Bethkes talk about, which you have there in your handout. He says to get the color back in your brain. And again, he's referring to the brain scans, which are showing loss of stimulation in those who are digitally addicted. The brain goes dark, right? Normal brain scan and right now it escapes me. Not quite sure what test they're using, but color in the brain shows activity going on there. And so he says to get color back in the brain and to bring down that wall, that dopamine wall, here's what he says. Remove all technology from bedrooms. Sleep deprivation due to technology is real. Turn off all push notifications. There is a preliminary study out of the University of South Africa that he was involved in that is showing, the preliminary results are showing that simply doing this will drop, will lower your cortisol levels, which are your stress hormones. So you feel less stress because you're not seeing all these ding, ding, ding coming through. For those who are digitally addicted or find it really hard to remove themselves from digital technology, replace your smartphones with dumb phones. He says you can't detox while you're using the drug, and that makes sense. I'm not sure anyone here is, but that should be an option. He says swap video games for board or card games, replace the electronic babysitters with humans. No music when studying or sleeping. Again, multitasking. If you're doing focused work, eliminate those distractions. And he says, quit believing that you are the exception to digital addiction. Now I want to cover what Jeff and Alyssa Bethke talked about. This was mentioned on a podcast that my wife and I listened to, and I remember they talked about it, so I chased down exactly what they put together. This was on one of their episodes of the Real Life podcast, which they host. They're not saying this is a must for everyone. They're only saying this is what we put together, and they kind of put it out there to those who listened as a way of, hey, these are ways to think about it. Put it together as you will. The first point they talk about is creation over consumption. And the reason for that is, as we studied in Genesis, the first act we see God doing is that of creation. And we're made in his image. We're made to create. Not creating to then go and sell it, but rather creating for the sake of creating. Could be as simple as drawing, gardening, leatherwork. What else is there? You know, biking, hunting and fishing, of course, you know, because that's what I do. Something, but create, because that's how we show the image of God. And they make the point that technology gets that create versus consume scale out of balance. We just there's a real danger to just simply being on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and we're just consuming. We're just spinning through content. We're making other people rich by doing so, because it's the way it's monetized. And there's also thoughts on consumption that we could get into, but that's not the point of tonight. And I added this. I said, fight to see technology as a tool, not a master. I think that create versus consume kind of starts getting towards that, that we want to see tech as tools. They talk about actively resisting the speed and connected nature of our culture throughout our week and lives. They advocate for tech Sabbaths. And they also say, just enjoy the downtime you have in your day. Why do you feel like you need to pull out your phone when you're in a long line at the checkout? Enjoy being. Just be. Don't do. They talk about shaping your space intentionally. Again, just having a phone present near you or in the same room as you is proven to make you less into the conversation you're having at the moment. And even when if we talk about education, it's shown to reduce cognitive ability. You're literally not as smart if your phone's in the same room as you are and you're trying to have a conversation with someone. So keep the phones, keep technology out of private spaces where you want, for example, bedrooms in particular. Dining rooms and bedrooms are sacred spaces. How do we protect that? If you're into music or you're into reading, have those readily at hand. Put your piano in the middle of the living room. Make that the place where you got a couple minutes. You sit down, plank, play around, whatever it is. But make creation the center space of your home and put technology on the fringe. Again, whatever that looks like for different families, let's talk it through. Fourthly, they said, we will not have screen time whatsoever for children. At the time they said this, their children were toddlers. I'm not quite sure where they are at with this in the moment. And then fifthly, they say, we use film to bond as family because as humans, we are wired for story. And they make the point that no one is allowed to watch alone while others are moving around the house. Stories are communal. And Jeff does admit, he's like, sometimes he allows his children to have the screen because it's like a daddy blessing his children. Just like, sure, enjoy it. But there's always that danger there of becoming dependent on that can happen. And lastly, in the 3 minutes we have left, trying to recap some crowdsourced questions. I was going to ask the question earlier and it slipped through and I didn't. But is technology immoral? Meaning, does technology have a moral bent? Or is it just as it is? There is a thought that technology is very similar to the pipes in our home. It simply carries information from place to place. And we don't think about the pipes unless something goes wrong. There's a leak, stuff is getting wet, and we need to fix it. McLuhan, and he has strong language on this, and I'm only offering it, I'm not saying this is necessarily my view, but he says, our conventional response to all media, namely that it's how they are used that counts, is the numb stance of the technological idiot. In other words, media is much more than neutral purveyors of information. They have the power to shape us regardless of content and cannot be evaluated solely upon their use. He goes on to say, the content of any particular medium has about as much importance as the stenciling on the case of an atomic bomb. His point is, the impact that the medium has, again, think about print or electronic, like that medium, is more important than what the content is that it's bringing along. So I was asked also to give just a couple of tips on being aware of the amount of time we may waste through meaningless scrolling. For all the stimulation that these guys provide us, they also come with ways to monitor, track, and control the time we spend with them. But it takes us setting up that schedule to make it happen. So there are things, both Apple and Android, they have ways of setting specific timers for specific apps. Say you want to spend 2 hours on Instagram, I say that's too much, let's advocate for something a little less than that. Whatever the time is, you can set that particular time on there. And once you reach that time, that's it for the rest of the day. They can be useful. Another option would be to set timers for bedtime. You can make your screen go dark or make it go into do not disturb mode or airplane mode where you're not receiving anything. Or even grayscale. Grayscale simply means it takes the color on your phone and turns it to differing shades of gray. And from personal experience, I can tell you, YouTube and Instagram are not fun when you don't have any color with it. So it's an effective tool as well. Another would be to remove the automated, curated news feeds that Apple and Google provide you. There are ways of doing that. And once I did that with mine, I'll just be honest, I started doing way less of the endless scrolling. So there is that as well. Also, for those of you who use Android, I'll give a specific app recommendation here, Stay Free. It's a digital well-being app. You can set, and it'll track your time. So there's different ways you can set it to monitor time spent on your phone, time spent on apps, time spent on specific websites. There are browser extensions as well, so you can track your time on your desktop or your laptop. I say for Android because I don't think it's available for Apple, but I'm sure something similar exists for Apple. I don't use it, so I'm not aware of it. Another question was, are there any real advantages to using a real Bible over an app on your phone? And again, I'm just offering it here. You can make the choice as you will. There's something with this that this doesn't have, and it's called heft. It sits in the hand. There's also the sensory advantage of hearing the pages turn, of feeling the pages turn, of seeing my underlined verses, etc. So there's a sensory advantage that I think this offers that an app may not. And again, research would show that you're more focused using a real Bible versus one on the phone. And again, that you're less present and more easily distracted if you have it on your phone. That being said, though, one big advantage that this having a Bible on this offers that this one doesn't is the ability to cycle back and forth between different translations. ESV, God's Word, The Message, whatever the case might be. As well as having the Spanish Bible on there, the Pennsylvania Dutch Bible on there, and if you want some sacred humor, the Hawaiian Pigden Bible as well. Bit of a hoot to read if you're into something like that. Now, I do want to talk about some of the resources I had, and if you're interested in this, I put a list down there on the bottom for you. Some that I would really recommend would be Brad Huddleston's video message that's on YouTube called Digital Cocaine. And again, he does a really good job of just talking through the addiction cycle. So that's a recommendation. Another one is Shane Hipp's book, The Hidden Power of Electronic Culture, and he goes into talking about into further detail on how that affects church and church culture. A lot of the things I talked about come directly from there. I have a copy. If you're interested in borrowing it, then just say something. And then Dr. Nicholas Carteros, author of the book Glow Kids. I didn't read it. I was just doing some internet browsing on that. And he's a trained psychologist working with digital addiction, in particular with young children. And his website has a number of sources that he cites from, talking about how digital addiction very much mirrors addiction to heroin and other substances, as well as like just the cognitive effects that screens and screen time has on children. So for you who have young children, it might be worth, that'd be one I'd recommend checking out as well. My papers up here. I do want to close. I do want to go back a little bit in closing here to that thought that the medium is the message. And again, I hope this. If you take away one thought from tonight, it's that we're more impacted by not by the content, but by the messenger, if you will, the medium. And going back to how we perceive the world, kind of somewhat based in our philosophy, somewhat based on the language or the alphabet that we grew up with. And I want to close with that quote on the bottom there of your worksheet. And I had a copy of the worksheet up here, and I can't find it. But as I was reading Shane Hipp's book, and he was really going kind of, it's a very readable book. I'm not saying it was hard to read, but just felt like some of these here concepts were a bit difficult for me to grasp. But when I came across this here paragraph, things really sharpened into focus for me. If the medium is the message, then as the church, it behooves us also to think about how we are portraying Christ to the world. We talk about this a lot. Comes up Sundays and in conversations. So I want to close with his paragraph here. If God's chosen medium was Christ, and the church is the body of Christ, then the church is God's chosen medium for God's ongoing revelation to the world. The church exists to embody, proclaim the good news of God's kingdom. If the medium is the message of the gospel is profoundly shaped by the way the church lives in the world. We are the medium.